action, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
Major funding for America Abroad is provided by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
From Public Radio International, I'm Ray Suarez.
And I'm Deborah Amos. And this is America Abroad. On the docket today, judging the International Criminal Court.
The International Criminal Court accuses Bashir of 5 counts of crimes against humanity in Darfur, including murder, extermination, torture, and rape.
Human rights groups applauded the International Criminal Court for issuing the arrest warrant, but then came Sudan's response, an order expelling humanitarian groups from Darfur. The UN says the expulsions will leave more than 1 million people without food aid, medical care.
The indictment of the president of Sudan for crimes against humanity has the ICC in the spotlight lately, and it's ratcheted up arguments about the ICC in the court of public opinion. Plaintiffs say the quest for justice in a place like Sudan could derail the pursuit of peace, but the defense rests on principle.
If you have a system of international criminal justice, there may be a price to pay, and part of the price may be making some peace settlements in some areas more difficult.
Richard Goldstone was chief prosecutor of the UN tribunals for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia.
You can't have a little bit of international justice. You either have it or you don't. You know, I don't believe a system of international justice can operate like a hot water faucet that you can turn on and off at will.
When the ICC opened its doors in The Hague, Netherlands, on July 1, 2002, its mandate was clear. Richard Goldstone.
The ICC has been set up really to investigate the worst, most serious war crimes, including genocide and crimes against humanity, and only against those in high positions. It's a small court with potentially a huge canvas.
The court's first trial, the prosecution of a Congolese warlord, opened in January of this year. And in an ideal world, the ICC won't have a heavy caseload.
It's a court of last resort, not first resort. The idea is that domestic courts should have the first option of investigating their own people, their own nationals. It's only where national courts cannot or will not do that the International Criminal Court assumes jurisdiction.
Throughout the last century, from Nuremberg to Africa's Great Lakes, capturing and trying war criminals has never been an open and shut case. International justice is often slow, political, and loaded with objections. In fact, many nations, from Russia to China, even the U.S., still haven't signed on to the court's charter.
There is a continuing tension between withdrawing impunity from the most serious war criminals on the one hand and interfering with the sovereignty of countries on the other. Many countries object to the International Criminal Court having jurisdiction over their national second-guessing decisions that their military has taken. Powerful countries don't like to be second-guessed.
Fears of a politically motivated show trial for American soldiers or lawmakers have many in the U.S. in contempt of the court. But while the politics of the day can make it seem like the court itself is on trial, the ICC still has a strong defense team, those who appeal to the notion that the court's existence is a sizable step forward for human rights and the global rule of law.
One can't divorce international justice from politics. There can be a tension between peace and justice. But you have to look at the bottom line and say, what kind of a world do we want? One with international justice? One where war criminals are going to be called to account? Are we a better world for having international criminal justice than we were without it? That's the issue.
And that's the issue we'll cross-examine this hour. Can the scales of justice balance the pursuit of peace with the need to punish war criminals? Does throwing the book at the world's worst offenders deter future crimes against humanity? And have international tribunals helped heal ethnic divisions and deliver closure for the victims of war crimes? This hour, I'll visit the former Yugoslavia, where for the last 15 years, an international tribunal has been investigating war criminals and trying to heal ethnic wounds in the Balkans.
But first, we turn to northern Uganda, where 20 years of war crimes by a rebel movement called the Lord's Resistance Army gave the ICC its first official case. But as America Abroad's Matt Ozug found, most ordinary Ugandans are opposed to the court, a court designed to prosecute the orchestrators of heinous crimes, atrocities which, we should warn you, include some grotesquely violent acts.
Joseph Kony is apparently a soft-spoken killer. Those who've met him say he only becomes animated when he's visited by a spirit that he says is God. For 2 decades, Kony and his key commanders in the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, have unleashed an unholy war in northern Uganda, killing over 60,000 of their own people. The LRA formed as an ethnic separatist movement that claimed to be defending northern Uganda against southern aggression. But Kony's army is now little more than a paranoid band of sadistic fighters. They use razor blades to slice the lips and ears off suspected informants. Kony also has a particular penchant for abducting children to fill his ranks. Some of those lucky enough to escape their LRA captors are brought here, to the World Vision Center in Gulu, Uganda. As I sit under a large tree, one recent returnee approaches me cautiously, looking at my tape recorder. I ask him his name, but he just taps the microphone. This doesn't seem like much, but according to Sam Lukung, a counselor here, it actually represents some progress.
You know, all these experiences that they had been going through has distorted their minds.
Sam describes a former client who wouldn't speak or eat for 2 months until one day.
One day, he said he wanted to tell me his story. Something very bad happened to him. One day they went for a parade. It was in the LRA camp. And during the parade, he couldn't get what the commander was saying. And there was also another boy who wasn't performing very well during the early morning parade. So the two of them were ordered out of the line. So the other boy, who was not performing also well, he was tied with ropes facing the tree. And then he was ordered to begin biting that boy. He should bite a mouthful of flesh from the back of that boy and spit it out. And if he didn't comply, he would be shot to death. So out of fear, he bit a lump full of flesh from the back of the boy, spat it out, bit again, spat it out. There was blood all over his face, but he was ordered to continue. So he said he kept on biting until midday when the boy died. And he was released to go back to his position. After his story, he cried a lot until we reunited him back to his family.
It was for crimes like these, murder, enslavement, and rape, among others, that the International Criminal Court indicted Joseph Kony and 4 of his top commanders. In December of 2003, Uganda's President Museveni invited the ICC's prosecutor to investigate the situation in northern Uganda. But without a police force of its own, the ICC is powerless to apprehend Kony. More than 5 years later, he's still on the run, and most northern Ugandans have been pushed into massive government camps, originally designed for their security. Pabo is Uganda's largest IDP, or internally displaced persons camp. John Wilson Ojuk just retired as the camp commander, and he wants to bring his family home so badly, he's ready to take a surprising step towards Joseph Kony.
We have forgiven him.
Forgiven him? It sounds shocking, but after 20 years of violence, maybe no price is too high for peace.
Can you pay 1,000 people with one person? Can it be enough for us? Better he better come home and see the problem he has caused to his people than taking him to ICC. For us, we see it is useless. Several times we have told him that we have forgiven him.
This might sound like a remarkable bit of moral gymnastics, but person after person here echoes the same feeling. Let him come home. Let's move on. Among those impatient with the pace of justice, there's a growing chorus for the ICC to drop its charges. In a CD store in Gulu, I heard there was even a pop song critical of the court.
You know the ICC song?
Yeah, I know.
ICC, What does he say?
Actually, it was giving advice to ICC. They are trying to say the ICC issue is contradicting the peace. Why? What are they doing here?
The song even compares the court to HIV, asking, is the ICC like HIV? If it catches you, you don't heal? These are critiques, though perhaps not so strongly worded, that Jimmy Oteam hears every day.
I am Jimmy Oteam. I work as a field outreach assistant with the International Criminal Court. We are leaving Gulu Town for Paicho. The road is pretty bad, but we are driving.
Oteam, himself a former abductee, has a tough job, keeping the public on the side of the ICC. The outreach team is the ICC's most visible presence here in Uganda. And folks here have a lot of questions about the court.
Among the commonest questions that I always raise is one, how to effect the arrest warrant. Because most of the time they ask you, look, you are telling us these people are criminal, and we really know they are criminal, but when are you arresting them? When are you prosecuting them? So for us, we tell them, you know, it's not that easy. It's not like running around looking for some criminal who is nearer to you. It takes time, but gradually, justice will always be delivered. We also try to cite example of the other tribunal, the International Criminal Tribunal. For instance, the one for former Yugoslavia. It took time, but again, at the end of the day, justice was administered.
We arrive in Paicho to an ocean of more than 200 women and children looking out expectantly. They're all gathered here to learn more about the court. Jimmy opens the floor, and the questions these women raise in a dusty village in northern Uganda are the thorny issues of implementation that the court must resolve. Why can't the ICC itself capture Kony? When will it be safe to leave the camps? Many are also perplexed by the fact that the ICC doesn't have a death penalty. Ajok Santa was abducted by the LRA along with five of her brothers.
What they really want is that Kony should be brought to Uganda when he's arrested and killed in front of everyone here in the north, other than taking him out there to The Hague, and we might feel that he's just going to be there very relaxed, not suffering. Yes, he should suffer because he has really tortured so many people. That is what people really want.
Despite Santa's certainty, there's actually no consensus on what to do with Kony. Military action is complicated by the fact that most of the LRA's fighters were themselves abducted by the rebels. On the other hand, negotiations with the rebels have consistently failed. Just before the peace talks broke down for good, Gulu Archbishop John Baptist Odama visited Kony's jungle hideout.
He said, I have a spear in my hand. I'm chasing peace to spear it so that people can eat. But at the same time, as I'm chasing peace, there is a lion coming behind me. Should I continue chasing peace and be eaten by the lion, which is the ICC, or should I fight against the ICC? And if I can be helped out of this, signing is not a problem.
Whether Kony would have actually signed a peace treaty is anybody's guess. But now, with an ICC warrant over his head, that seems increasingly less likely. Yet many Ugandans seem willing to grant Kony amnesty through a traditional peace ritual, if that would end the violence. Although not everyone agrees.
For me, these people must be held accountable.
Jimmy Oteam, the ICC outreach worker, takes the long view and argues for patience, saying peace deals are too easily broken. But a trial could itself be a way to heal.
You know, the atrocity Kony and his group committed is so terrible, so horrible, that nothing else can heal apart from seeing that person tried and justice is done. So for me, the day I see Kony tried in court and prosecuted, I'll be a happy man.
For America Abroad, I'm Matt Ozug.
To see photos from Uganda, visit americaabroad.org. Coming up after the break, Ray Suarez walks us through the international community's fledgling steps towards a world court.
I'm Ray Suarez, and you're listening to Judging the ICC from America Abroad.
The greatest war crimes trial in modern history proceeds at Nuremberg, with Hermann Göring, Rudolf Hess, and ex-Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop playing star roles. Worldwide News Service and a corps of court reporters record thousands of words of testimony and accusation, while transoceanic telephones and cables are flooded with dispatches detailing the progress of this dramatic aftermath of global war.
At the end of World War II, the victorious Allied powers spent the time, energy, and money to see that justice was done. They were rewarded with the most successful international tribunal in history, but through much of the 20th century, the international will to prosecute war crimes displayed at Nuremberg was in short supply.
So even liberal governments, I think, are really torn when it comes to issues of international justice.
Gary Bass is a professor of international relations at Princeton University and author of Stay the Hand of Vengeance, The Politics of War Crimes Tribunals.
That on the one hand, they have this sort of principled, idealistic commitment that atrocities deserve to be punished, and this sort of distinctly legalistic-minded way of thinking about punishment. So punishment doesn't just mean shooting the bad guys. Punishment means some kind of trial.
But the high-minded ideals of liberal states often run up against the high price of justice.
The bad news is that even beyond that, liberal states are still states. There's still a distinct selfishness to the way that they make their foreign policy. And they worry about paying too high a price for the pursuit of justice.
Justice came at too high a price in the aftermath of the First World War. Rounding up and trying German and Ottoman leaders proved difficult for the Allies and evoked national outrage from Constantinople and Berlin. It was no surprise, then, that when Allied leaders gathered to devise a strategy for the end of the Second World War, they barely mentioned the idea of trials.
It's 3 days now since we heard officially from the Soviet news agency TASS that President Roosevelt, Prime Minister Churchill, and Marshal Stalin had met in Tehran for a momentous council of war.
Gary Bass.
It's a meeting of the big three of the Americans, the Brits, and the Soviets. And Stalin gets up in front of Churchill and FDR and makes a toast to the Red Army, and also says what he thinks should be done with German war criminals, which is to shoot between 50 and 100,000 of them. FDR says, tries to make a joke out of it and says, Marshal Stalin, don't you think that 49,000 would be enough? And Churchill, who takes Stalin much more seriously, storms out, says, you know, I'd rather be shot myself than listen to this.
Even in the United States, Roosevelt's cabinet hotly debated whether top Nazi chiefs should be summarily shot. Cooler heads eventually prevailed, and Roosevelt opted for the witness dock over the chopping block. The chief prosecutor at Nuremberg was the American Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson.
The privilege of opening the first trial in history for crimes against the peace of the world imposes a grave responsibility. The wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated.
With the Allies in complete control of Germany, there was both the will and the way to bring the Third Reich's leaders to justice. The trial demonstrated Allied restraint and laid bare Nazi crimes.
For five savage and bloody years, humanity has waited for this moment of retribution, when the insane ambitions of men like these would come up against the stone wall of world justice. Stryker, Funk, Schacht, and their colleagues. 11 will hang, 6 will be jailed, 3 are acquitted.
The wind was in the sails of international justice after the triumph at Nuremberg. In 1948, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Genocide Convention. That began the push toward the creation of an international criminal court. But momentum was snuffed out during the Cold War. It took more than four decades for the globe to again turn to the idea of international courts. As the Cold War ended, ethnic conflicts heated up, especially in the Balkans.
A major battle seems to have begun for control of the Bosnian capital of Sarajevo. Lightly armed Muslim militia fight Serbian forces, which have heavy artillery in surrounding hills and air support above.
The Clinton administration and its NATO allies hope to avoid being dragged into the fighting. So instead of deploying troops, the international community sent in the judges.
At the United Nations, the Security Council has voted to set up a war crimes tribunal. 11 judges, 300 lawyers, whose job will be to judge those charged with war crimes in what used to be Yugoslavia, if the accused, including some of Yugoslavia's top leaders, can ever be brought to trial.
Again, Gary Bass.
Now, obviously, prosecuting war crimes, great. That's powerfully correct thing to do. But it looks a little bit less impressive when you're not actually stopping the crimes that are being committed. It's a little bit like having Nuremberg without actually winning World War II first.
Even after the 1995 Dayton Accords brought a fragile peace to the Balkans, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, or ICTY, had a difficult time getting NATO troops to haul in indicted war criminals. Despite its assurances to the contrary, the Clinton administration was not interested in expending much blood or treasure to help the United Nations court. Lead U.S. negotiator at Dayton, Richard Holbrooke, was interviewed on CNN.
Well, what about the reports that Radovan Karadzic, the Serbian political leader, was allowed to pass through as many as four I-4 checkpoints?
I don't know if the story is exactly true. I believe it probably is. They're now being asked not to let it happen again. There are going to be moments where you're not going to be able to engage a person if he's barreling through with a heavily armed bodyguard on a road which is supposed to be open. But we don't want to leave people like Karadzic and Mladic uncontested. They are indicted war criminals.
Again, Gary Bass.
The language is that peacekeeping troops that encounter war crime suspects in the course of their regular peacekeeping duties can, if they think it's a good idea, they can make arrests, but they don't have to. So that's a pretty weak mandate.
As we'll hear later in the program, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is still a focus of frustration for many in the Balkans. In 1994, the Security Council had again voted to create an international tribunal, this time to prosecute the perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide. But there was a growing feeling that more was needed.
The scale of tribal genocide has been breathtaking. 200,000 civilians were slaughtered in 3 weeks. 250,000 fled to Tanzania. Everyone agrees something has to be done, but what and by whom?
Well, there's this sense of frustration with the ex-Yugoslavia tribunal and the Rwanda tribunal because they only look at the Balkans and at Rwanda. And there's this sense that it is a little bit bizarre that there's an effort at justice in these little bits of the world, but not in the whole world. I mean, if human rights are human rights, they apply equally in all times and in all places, in all countries everywhere. So a more logical form would be a court that had jurisdiction over all war crimes across the globe. And out of that logic comes the push for the International Criminal Court.
In round after round of United Nations committee meetings, an international criminal court took shape. Support came from non-governmental organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, which staunchly backed the court. And it also came from the White House. President Bill Clinton spoke to the UN General Assembly in September 1997.
To punish those responsible for crimes against humanity and to promote justice so that peace endures, we must maintain our strong support for the UN's war crime tribunals and truth commissions. And before the century ends, we should establish a permanent international court to prosecute the most serious violations of humanitarian law.
Less than a year later, delegates gathered at a UN conference in Rome to vote on a treaty to establish the International Criminal Court. 120 nations, more than enough to approve the treaty,
judged the criminal court a good idea. But during the final negotiations over the treaty for the new court, the U.S. balked. The Clinton administration and many in Congress worried there were not enough safeguards to prevent politically motivated prosecutions by the ICC.
Delegates to a United Nations conference in Rome voted overwhelmingly tonight to create the world's first permanent war crimes tribunal. The United States was strongly opposed and voted against. Concerned about its troops deployed in hotspots, the U.S. had sought the right to veto prosecution of any American citizen.
U.S. opposition to the court continued under President George W. Bush. The new president shared the same concern as his predecessor when it came to the prosecution of American soldiers and harbored a skepticism of international institutions. President Bush addressed U.S. servicemen at Fort Drum, New York in 2002, just days after the ICC treaty was ratified.
You might have heard about a treaty that would place American troops under the jurisdiction of something called the International Criminal Court. The United States cooperates with many other nations to keep the peace, but we will not submit American troops to prosecutors and judges whose jurisdiction we do not accept.
The Obama administration recently signaled a new interest in working with the International Criminal Court, but questions about the effectiveness of the court do linger, and justice delayed is starting to seem like justice denied. The ICC only just began to hear trials, more than 6 years after coming into existence. But for Gary Bass, the bar for international trials can't be set too high.
So it shouldn't be a question of do these things work well, because they won't work very well, because nothing is going to work very well. It should be a question of do they work better than the alternatives, you know, compared to the original American position of just shooting the Nazi war criminals. I think it's much better that we had Nuremberg. I think that's a real, you know, that's a real achievement. But always I think the question has to be not do war crimes tribunals work, but do they work compared to what? Compared to impunity, compared to vengeance. And there I think the record of international justice looks much better.
I'm Ray Suarez for America Abroad. Coming up after the break, Deborah Amos travels to the Balkans to learn what effect the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has had upon those living in the wake of war. For more on this program, including an interactive timeline of international criminal tribunals and a full transcript of our interview with Gary Bass, visit us online at americaabroad.org.
Support for America Abroad is provided by the Star Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, the Stewart Family Foundation, Foreign Affairs, online at foreignaffairs.org, and from the American Interest, a magazine devoted to illuminating America's global role. Support also comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Ray Suarez, and you're listening to Judging the ICC from America Abroad. As we've explored so far, the International Criminal Court is still in its infancy as a world body, and its first real trial is barely underway. So to get a better sense of what lies ahead for the court and those seeking international justice, we turn to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia to discover what lessons that process reveals.
The United Nations established the Ad Hoc Tribunal in 1993. Its mandate is to investigate and prosecute those responsible for the brutal ethnic violence and mass atrocities taking place in Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and later in Serbia and Kosovo. The court has charged more than 160 high-level government and military officials. As the tribunal is slowly winding down, Deborah Amos takes us to The Hague and to the former Yugoslavia to investigate whether the ICTY has helped deliver justice and heal ethnic wounds.
I'm standing in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. This old stone building once housed a Dutch insurance company. Now, it's come to symbolize accountability for war crimes. Over the past 15 years, judges and lawyers from more than 80 countries have tried to assess blame. And despite the lack of a police force, a surprising number of people have been brought here to justice. We'll look at the successes and the failures of this court, from the lives of the victims to those who work here.
In what capacity were you meeting him?
On any day, as many as six trials are underway, the proceedings broadcast throughout the building. Our first stop, a cramped office off the lobby, the headquarters of the SENS news agency. Journalists here monitor every trial and broadcast weekly highlights to the Balkans.
My name is Mirko Klarin. I'm editor-in-chief of SENS news agency. What we are doing here is try to collect the facts about those events and to tell those facts to people there, you know, just because they don't know. They have been brainwashed for so many years there, you know.
Establishing facts is one success of the tribunal, but the goal of reconciliation in the Balkans has fallen short. In this three-way conflict, no side wants to admit guilt. For Klarin, what's important is to limit denial, which comes in
Good afternoon, folks. Meteorologist Dan Pounder in the Weather Office, WILL. Just a quick reminder, a flash flood warning for Clark County in east central Illinois is still in effect until 6 p.m. this evening.
Mitzi has committed crimes. It's much more difficult to deny those crimes because the denial is the most important on all sides, not only Serbian, but also in Croatian and Bosnian.
161 war criminals have been indicted. Most have been tried and sentenced, including heads of state and wartime generals. But one of the biggest fish in the murky waters of the Balkans is still at large. Ratko Mladic, the Bosnian Serb commander charged with genocide in the town of Srebrenica. He and Milan Hadic are the tribunal's last fugitives. All ongoing cases have to be complete by 2011 because the tribunal is closing down. Chief Prosecutor Serge Bramets makes his case that the mission is not quite completed.
When I'm speaking with diplomats, politicians, some of them thinking that it's time to close the tribunal and to turn the page and to concentrate on other issues, I'm always saying, please speak with those victims' organizations. For them, it's still daily business. They are still confronted with still not knowing where their brothers are, their husbands are, their fathers are.
It's also important, says Bramerts, to begin the trials and soon for the remaining fugitives so the tribunal mandate is complete.
We are absolutely convinced that the only really good solution is to have both arrested as soon as possible, to have them tried during the current lifetime of the tribunal. And it's important that this job is finished properly.
But the tribunal is dependent on reluctant national governments to carry out arrests. Compliance has come through political pressure. For example, in Serbia, the leverage is this: turn over suspects as one condition for acceptance into the European Union. Richard Dicker heads the International Justice Program at Human Rights First.
That doesn't diminish the character or the quality of justice rendered. It's a reflection of how fragile this new phenomenon of international justice still is 15 years after it first came into being.
In Belgrade, Serbia's capital, The tribunal is still viewed with suspicion, and public opinion counts. Serbs want to be part of the European Union. But while promising to find the fugitives and arrest them, when talking to Serbian audiences, political leaders speak against the verdicts in The Hague. On the shopping street here, Mladen Niković, a young businessman, reflects widespread opinion that justice falls too heavily on the Serbs.
So we could see generals from Bosnia, Croatia, to be prosecuted for their crimes, that would be like more equal, and then probably there would be no problems here.
Is that what you think?
That's what I think.
An opinion that doesn't surprise Natasha Kandic, the director of the Humanitarian Law Center in Belgrade. She says Serbs don't want to be seen as aggressors.
They would like to see that Serbs are equal with others. They don't have a political message who will say, it's not true, look at the fact, majority of the crimes are committed by Serbs.
On the outskirts of the capital, I meet Kandic again on the steps of Belgrade's National War Crimes Court. Here, war crimes trials will continue long after the ICTY closes down. The Serbian media records the scene. Kandic welcomes a group of Croats from the town of Vukovar.
And the families of victims, they are the best monitors. For them it's very important to know what's happened. Valerija nije mogla da dođe.
Ne, mama je baš stvarno loše I nije mogla.
Kandic escorts the families through the heavy security and into the courtroom. Here, Serbs are accused of taking part in the murder of 200 Croats in one of the worst massacres of POWs in the Balkan conflict of the 1990s. The families of the victims have come to see the verdict. The National War Crimes Court is counted as a success for the International Tribunal. Trials in Belgrade are enhanced by evidence collected at The Hague. It's a partnership that strengthens local justice. In 2005, one particular piece of evidence had a profound effect. This homemade video was introduced as evidence at The Hague and then repeatedly broadcast in the Balkans. Again, Richard Dicker.
It had a profoundly jolting and jarring effect on the Serbian population, who had been predisposed to regard crimes allegedly committed by Serbs against Bosnians as propaganda.
The pictures show six Bosnian men being taken from a truck with their hands tied behind their backs. They were lined up and shot.
This was proof positive of the most bone-chilling, cold type to demonstrate what was done to this group of Bosnian men, and it looked as if the killers were on a lark in the woods.
This killing was one event in the more extensive war crimes committed in Srebrenica. Some 8,000 Muslim men and boys were murdered in an act of ethnic cleansing ruled a genocide by the International Court. Natasha Kandic was instrumental in getting those facts broadcast on Serbian TV, which some Serbs were willing to acknowledge.
People called daily, 100 daily of them, telling, thank you very much, it is very important for us to see what's happened, to see policemen, to see victims. And, you know, public opinion was on the side of victims. It was the first time.
The war in the Balkans cost 100,000 lives. The legacy of the conflict can be seen most starkly in Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina. This open-air fruit and vegetable market is a war memorial. 67 names are listed on a red glass wall. Those who died when a mortar shell exploded in the middle of a sunny winter day in 1994. Rafik Hojic is the outreach coordinator for the International Tribunal in Sarajevo.
If you look all around you, shrapnel damage on the facades of these buildings can tell you that we have a lot to do to deal with the legacy of what happened here.
We arrive at the National War Crimes Court for Bosnia-Herzegovina. The tribunal's mission will go on for decades here after the international court closes down. The current estimate, 5,000 war criminals should face prosecution. But for Hojic, justice has limits. Establishing facts can't undo ethnic cleansing or force people to come to terms with the past.
I think you feel the weight of the war everywhere in this country. It is not only the damage to buildings, it is the people who carry the darkness of those years. We have resolved nothing. So many people are left to themselves to deal with the consequences of what happened to them.
Here, international justice is a mixed success. The architects of ethnic cleansing have been jailed, but the ethnic partition of Bosnia endures. For example, only a small portion of Bosnian Muslims driven out of Srebrenica returned. Many of the widows now live in a suburb of Sarajevo. Zanita Mucic remembers every detail of July 11, 1995, when her son Karim was taken away by armed Bosnian Serb men. She never saw him again.
Kira Mucic, Kemal Mucic, Ajove Kiram.
Her younger son escaped through the woods that day. He survived and now lives in Kentucky. Daughter Safika Mucic also remembers that day. She was 7 years old at the time.
Yes, I never forget the last time I watched my brother. You know, I never forget, believe me. It's so hard talking about that.
Safika is now 21. She follows the rulings at the International Tribunal. She's relieved when wartime leaders are tried and sentenced. But justice cannot redraw the maps or return Srebrenica to what it was before the war.
Justice. Yeah. No. I think that no justice for Srebrenica. No justice.
How to judge justice in the Balkans? Perhaps the victims' expectations were too high, the politicians' efforts too small to turn war crimes verdicts into reconciliation. Richard Dicker points to the precedent of an earlier tribunal, Nuremberg, where it took years and a new generation to come to terms with justice.
We all heard about the Nuremberg Tribunal and the significance of the trials of the Nazi leadership at the end of the Second World War. And it took several decades and a new generation of young Germans to begin to ask and seek answers for the tough questions about what their parents' generation had been doing during the years of the Holocaust. So we should be open to the prospect of applying a longer time frame before we make conclusions.
I'm Deborah Amos for America Abroad.
I'm Ray Suarez, and here with me now to talk about the ICC's effectiveness as an arbiter of international justice and about the debate over what America's relationship should be and could be with the International Criminal Court, are Leslie Vinjamuri, assistant professor in the Department of Politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, and John Bellinger, former legal advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Thank you both for joining us. A case currently before the court, and in this case one supported by the United States, is the case against Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, recently indicted by the ICC for war crimes and crimes against humanity. But already you can hear the critique that this kind of pursuit of justice in Sudan may be an impediment to achieving peace.
Well, it certainly has caused some difficulties. And frankly, this is one of the original concerns that the United States government, going back to the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, have had about the International Criminal Court is a unaccountable prosecutor. That's not to suggest that the prosecutor right now, Moreno Ocampo, has done a bad job, but simply he is so independent from the Security Council and the rest of the UN system and from member states that he has, and has in this case taken actions that have thrown events in Sudan essentially into a tailspin, so that human rights organizations who are doing work in Sudan are being harassed or kicked out because of the arrest warrants that have been brought by the prosecutor. Now, once this arrest warrant has been brought, the Bush administration, Secretary Rice in particular, did support the arrest warrant once it was brought. We did not want to let Bashir off the hook, and I think that's been the position of the Obama administration as well. So the damage essentially has been done now. The arrest warrants have been brought, and we don't want to suggest that Bashir can get off the hook by wriggling out.
But Leslie Vinjamuri, wasn't that prosecutorial independence important in the very design of the court so it didn't become the judicial arm of the Security Council?
I think actually I would agree with John on this, that the U.S. concern was actually a very valid one. And what we've seen happen is that the International Criminal Court has moved very squarely into the domain of being one of the key actors engaged in trying to bring peace and affect the peace process in situations of ongoing conflict. And once you really become a player in that domain, then having an independent prosecutor that isn't working much more carefully with the Security Council does become a very much more complicated issue. And so the U.S. concern, I think, is very legitimate with respect to that issue.
Well, John Bellinger, you don't get very far into a debate on the International Criminal Court before the issue of state sovereignty comes up. You're talking about a court with people charging that the ICC can reach inside and trump domestic judicial processes. In the operation of the court, have we seen that that's a legitimate concern?
Certainly, I think the Sudanese have suggested, Sudan is not a party to the Rome Statute, that this is interfering with their sovereignty. The concern of the Clinton and really obviously even more so of the Bush administration was that the ICC could assert jurisdiction over countries, and particularly, of course, the United States, even though we're not a party to the Rome Statute. It's fine if you sign up to a treaty and agree to have its jurisdiction cover you, but the United States was gravely concerned, and I think this is a concern to our Congress, to our Senate, and even to the American people. So it hasn't happened yet, but that is the theoretical concern, and that is going to be the challenge, I think, for the Obama administration, which will understandably want to, I think, develop a somewhat warmer relationship with the ICC, but the original concerns of the United States government have not yet been addressed.
Leslie Vinjamuri, do you think the ICC will be getting a second look from the Obama administration?
I think it will. I mean, certainly at the level of pronouncements, there's going to be an effort to try and appear to be much more familiar and close to the ICC. But, of course, it's a much more complicated political process. I tend to think that the fears that the United States has expressed over sovereignty are fears that are really much more legitimately expressed by the states who have been targeted so far, but that the protections that the ICC affords to the United States and other advanced democratic countries are really quite strong.
I'd agree, Ray, with that, with Leslie. I mean, I think it's highly unlikely that we would see U.S. officials or U.S. military people brought before the ICC because the Rome Statute is intended to complement U.S. domestic law. Other countries do certainly feel, though, that their sovereignty is being threatened by the ICC, and we're quite interestingly beginning to see a backlash from other countries and not just the concerns expressed by the United States.
Well, guests, time for closing arguments. In this program, we've heard a fair amount of apathy, ambivalence, in some cases outright animosity toward the ICC. So where do we go from here? What do each of you see as the future path for the court and the critical benchmarks going forward? John Bellinger?
For important reasons, the United States has always been a supporter of international criminal justice and accountability for those who commit crimes against humanity. But domestically, and this is what is often difficult, I think, for the world to understand, given Washington bureaucratic politics, as much as President Obama communicates and tries to convince people that the United States ought to become party to the ICC, it will be very difficult for him to become party unless changes were made, given that President Clinton had originally said that he would not submit it to the Senate unless our concerns are addressed. So I expect over the next couple of years we will see a somewhat warmer attitude towards the ICC, some cooperation. But the big question is going to be at this review conference in 2010, will the United States seek some changes to the Rome Statute to address its concerns? And will the international community agree to those changes, which, in fact, may be unlikely?
Leslie Vinjamuri?
I think it's important, just as one follow-up, and then let me say a few things, to note that the data on how the American public feel about the ICC suggests that to the extent that they know about it, the majority of Americans tend to be very supportive. So that's a real source of potential support for the ICC. In terms of how the ICC is going to do, I think it really does come down to how these two crucial cases, Uganda and especially Sudan, are handled. The problem is, I think, a typical problem of a new institution is that the ICC has moved very, very quickly. It's wanted to have a high profile, and it's perhaps moved too quickly into this domain of trying to be a real player when it comes to solving the problem of war and peace. And it also, I think, the general feeling about the ICC is going to have a lot to do with whether or not the ICC moves forward with a case that's not located in Africa. This is really what people are waiting to see. They're waiting to see whether this court really is about supporting accountability globally and not just in Africa. So I think the future case law will be absolutely crucial. And to the extent that the ICC could try and move back towards notions of really thinking about guilt and innocence rather than just simply about deterrence and making peace, it may actually have much greater capacity for being successful over the long run.
Leslie Vinjamuri and John Bellinger, thanks for joining us. John Bellinger is the former legal advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and Leslie Vinjamuri is assistant professor in the Department of Politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. You've been listening to Judging the ICC from America Abroad. For photos, transcripts, and additional interviews, including the full interview with Richard Goldstone, visit us on the web at americaabroad.org. There you can sign up for our monthly podcast and comment on this program. Aaron Lobel is our executive producer. Our program was produced by Monica Bushman, Sean Carberry, Matt Ozug, Monica Villavicencio, and Chris Williams. Our director of broadcasting and station relations is Steve Martin. Four-piece suit composed our theme music. For Deborah Amos, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad from Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Donovan Campbell led a platoon of 40 men in urban warfare in Iraq. He says to be an effective platoon leader, you can't think of home, you can't miss your wife. You can only pretend you're already dead and thus free yourself to focus on your mission and your men. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Campbell about his new memoir. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Here's the weather forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area from meteorologist Daniel Pounder. Mostly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms for the rest of the day. The high 77, showers continuing tonight, the low 63. Mostly cloudy with showers tomorrow. The high 77, showers continuing Tuesday night, the low 64. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM, 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana.
यहाँ ब्लू लाइन